You've been described as Miss Darnby, that you look on life with grave suspicion. The brighter the prospects, the deeper the gloom. What do you say about that?
I suppose it must be true. I don't know why. Perhaps it's because, you know, when things go well, it is a bit alarming. I sometimes think that I've had so much luck and so much good fortune that it frightens me somehow.
Funny?
Oh.
Formidable.
If scandal is to your taste, Miss Mackay, I shall give you a feast.
And never anything less than fabulous. Dame Maggie Smith was truly one of a kind. Now, very much missed by her admirers and friends all over the world.
And she's completely one off, Max. Completely one off.
In a slugging fest of acting, this woman was, you know, she was incomparable.
I mean, she was incredible.
She could make you cry, she could make you laugh, she could do it all.
Here, we're looking back on Maggie's extraordinary career, celebrating the prime of this great dame. The characters she played, the impeccable comic timing.
I'd rather earn my living down a mine.
And yes, the corsets.
And I'm always in corsets, and I'm always in wigs, and I'm always in those button boots. It's sort of like a kind of... It's typecasting, I suppose.
And we'll be reminding ourselves of the moments when we met the real Maggie, behind all the wonderful roles that dazzled and delighted us across the decades.
A montage of portraits of the blue-eyed actor at different stages of her long career. Maggie Smith at the BBC, narrated by Celia Imrie. The Graham Norton Show in 2015. The tall actor leads Maggie by the hand onto Graham's red and purple set, and the host steps forward to shake her warmly by the hand.
Hello.
He greets her with a kiss on the hand.
Thank you so much.
And a peck on both cheeks. Members of the studio audience stand and applaud as she settles onto Graham's sofa with Alex.
It's a big deal. They don't stand up for people.
Did they stand up?
They did. Not all of them, but some of them do.
A well-deserved standing ovation. That was in 2015. Maggie was 80, and to her amazement, better known than ever before. As Professor McGonagall in the Harry Potter films, she bewitched a whole new generation.
Sherbert Lennon.
Playing Downton Abbey's Lady Violet, demonstrated once again how she really was a cut above. Over six decades, Maggie had established herself as one of our greatest ever acting talents. And in September, her death prompted tributes from across the world. Actors, directors and writers calling her the very best they'd ever worked with and the one who had taught them the most.
I haven't known her for a long, long time. Very funny, very, very funny, and unbelievably witty, and really sweet and special friend.
I certainly agree with that. There was no one to touch her. I was lucky enough to work with Maggie in India. She was one moment heartbreaking, the next hilarious. She is my inspiration, but my lasting memory of her will always make me laugh.
I'm pretty sure we're going to propose soon enough. Just because I'm looking at you when you talk, don't think I'm interested. Or even listening.
Thing is, I don't know who to say yes to.
Well...
Yes?
No, I don't care.
Fulsome praise was nothing new to Maggie. That late burst of huge fame she experienced doesn't mean that she wasn't always much loved and appreciated. And here's some early evidence of that. A programme dedicated to Maggie from a series called Acting in the 60s, which began with an introduction that feels very much of the time.
High comedy actresses in Britain usually come from Kensington or try to sound as if they do. Maggie Smith was born in Ilford, Essex, and it's illustrative of the change that's come over the English theatre in the past 10 years that she's never tried to sound as if she came from anywhere else. For her age and weight, she's arguably the most versatile girl on the English stage. Where female performers are concerned, comedy usually means the battle of the sexes. Audiences love the sight of a spunky virgin cleverly outwitting masculine designs on her bed, and Maggie Smith handles such parts with a beady-eyed finesse that works just as well in Restoration comedy as it does in Broadway imports.
This is Maggie's first big BBC interview, the first of not too many, considering her long career. But the rare moments when she did open up were always fascinating viewing, and here we find her telling interviewer Clive Goodwin how everything started.
I decided to go to drama school. I mean, I'd made up my mind to do that anyway before I left school. And they started a drama school in Oxford, where I live. And it was attached at that time to the Playhouse. And I went there for 2 years. I wanted very much to go to RADA. I mean, it was everybody's dream to go to RADA, and my parents, I suppose, quite rightly, didn't want me to go to London when I was 16 and live on my own.
And from drama school you went where?
When I was at the Playhouse, I used to work in university productions because they did an awful lot of them there. And they did lots of cabarets and revues, and they were all sort of run by Ned Sherrin, Desmond O'Donovan, people like that. And I did those endlessly. And, you know, if you were bright enough at Oxford, you could almost do weekly rep round the colleges. You could get enough productions to do a term to keep you very busy.
And you were playing light parts, comedy parts?
Yes, always. Review. I was always in revue and cabaret. I don't know why. I did do Twelfth Night for Owls. I suppose that was one of the earliest things I did. And then
playing
Viola. Viola. And then the reviews that I was in were taken up to Edinburgh, and we did Fringe productions. I think it was sort of about the first Fringe shows up there.
It was through one of those late night reviews that you got the mythical break.
The break. Yes, it was in one of them we did on the Fringe, and they brought down to London, to the Watergate, which doesn't exist anymore, the Watergate Theatre. I can't remember which one it was called now. I think it was Oxford 8 or one of those things, which was seen by the American director who then took me to Broadway. You know. It was moderately successful, yes. I mean, it was rather sad because everybody in it expected it to be a huge success, as the one before had been, and obviously it wasn't. And everybody who went into it thought, oh, we're going to come out stars, you know, because...
Did you think that?
I don't know what I think. I was so overwhelmed at the thought of going. In actual fact, I didn't enjoy it at all, but I was so excited by it. I mean, I thought anything could happen. I suppose I must have thought I would come back a great, huge star.
That early disappointment was something Maggie revisited in this chat with Michael Aspel 3 years later.
Maggie Smith's cinema. In black and white, Maggie is facing Michael Aspel across a table on a set shaped like a reel of celluloid film, dominated by a large screen.
Maggie Smith, you were doing undergrad review when you were whisked away in 1956 to America. What did they whisk you away for?
They whisked me away, unfortunately, to do a review. I mean, I was glad that they wanted me to go, but I'd never wanted to do review, but it was seemed a big opportunity. It was my first job in the professional theatre, so I went.
And how long were you there?
I was there for a year.
Was it a valuable experience?
It was valuable in as much as I realised how tough and unpleasant it could be.
It was bad, was it?
I didn't enjoy it.
So you didn't want to do a review, you've always wanted to be a serious actress.
Yes, I always have, and it was very strange because when I came back, the first thing I did was another review here. And once you start in a line of things, it's always very hard to get out.
So, a clear desire to move on, but decades later, when getting together with old friends, the memories of those early review days felt fond and enduring.
In Nothing Like a Dame from 2018, Maggie is with Eileen Atkins, Judy Dench and Joan Plowright.
Also look the other way, you can tickle and squeeze as much as you please, but don't you go too far, cause Timothy's under the table and he's bound to tell his ma. Why do I remember that?
What is that?
It's the musical we win. Hark, hark, the fart.
Listen to the wind. It's called Listen to the Wind.
Yes.
It's a terrible, terrible.
It is a terrible.
That's what Ronnie called it. It's hark, hark, the fart.
Sit on the table, so look the other way. You can shuffle and squeeze as much as you please, but don't you go too far. He's bound to tell his ma.
You've said that it is easier for you to play funny ladies rather than straight ones.
Yes, but I mean, I've always been interested in funny ladies that aren't necessarily the ladies in review.
What's your favourite sort of comedy role, then?
Well, there are many. I mean, I enjoy playing the one I'm playing at the moment. I think I've probably enjoyed most of all so far playing Hay Fever, the Noel Coward one.
Hay Fever.
So nice to me. Have you got a plan about something?
How suspicious you are.
I can't help it. You're very attractive, and I'm always suspicious of attractive people on principle.
It's not a very good principle.
Well, I'll tell you something strictly between ourselves.
Oh, do.
You're wrong about me.
Wrong? In what way?
I write very bad novels.
Well, don't be ridiculous.
Well, you know I do, because you're an intelligent person.
Well, I don't know any such thing.
Well, tell me why you're being so nice to me.
Because I want to be.
Why?
I think you're a very clever and amusing man, and I think I've rather lost my heart to you.
Oh, shall we elope?
Oh, David.
Oh, you've called me.
I had the pleasure of working with Maggie Smith, was it two or three times? Two, I think. Or as she said to some, yes, Timothy Paul's playing my servant again. She'd been directed and worked with Noel Coward on the stage. And with this whole, she spans a generation of those amazing people.
By now, critics were drawing comparisons between Maggie and the theatre legend Dame Edith Evans, who she appeared with in Hay Fever, and whose approach to acting and comedy came up in this enlightening appearance on the Michael Parkinson programme.
Someone once said that the star's dictum about never acting with children or animals should also be applied to my next guest. Someone else said that she sighs with the air of one whose foot has just found another banana skin. And somebody else remarked that she had a voice like a strangulated dove. But all those are just tags to inadequately describe one of Britain's finest actresses. She won an Oscar for her performance in The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie and has been nominated for another Oscar for her latest film, Travels with My Aunt. And here she is in a scene from that film.
Tell me, Henry, what do you actually do at the bank?
Oh, well, I'm the man with all the keys.
Oh, then you could rob the bank.
Yes, of course. But I wouldn't.
Oh, but if you were desperate for money, a great deal of money.
Aunt Augusta, one just doesn't.
Why not?
I could never be a criminal. I learned early on that we get out of life precisely what we put into it. No more, no less.
Balls.
Parkinson chortles out the clip.
What did the lady say? Ladies and gentlemen, Maggie Smith.
Dressed in a snug-fitting floor-length black dress with a high collar, long sleeves and matching belt with a jewelled buckle, Maggie joins Michael and Poet Laureate John Betjeman.
Can we talk a bit about acting now and style? I had Robert Helpman on the programme last week, Maggie, and he was saying that when he was learning about theatre, he went to watch all the great actresses like Edith Evans and came to the conclusion that the great thing that they had was a style which was mainly a voice. Is that something that you would agree with? That they did things with their voices that other people were unable to do?
I don't think that is quite true. I think to a certain extent, I think it has more to do with the phrasing of things and the way you can turn certain lines.
You mean say certain lines in different ways and give it different meaning?
Yes, phrasing or stressing, various things like that.
Is there an example?
I can't believe that it is all in a voice.
No.
I do hope not, because mine isn't frightfully good. As you just said, it sounded like a strangled... What was it?
A strangulated dove, but I didn't say that.
Dove?
Dove.
Oh, I thought you said duck.
No.
Dove is infinitely better. I should relax somewhat.
Can you give an example of the way that you can, by using your voice and inflection, change the sense, the meaning of something?
It's frightfully difficult to do, and it's one of those curious things that if you do get a laugh on a certain line, which is unexpected, I mean, I can only talk about laughs because that is an immediate thing. I've done it once in a play, a coward play, not the one I'm in, because I would, the moment you say something is funny, it's gossamer, it's gone,
yes,
really.
Yes.
I had one line which was very small and not really very funny, and I had to say at a breakfast, this haddock is disgusting. And it is not funny. I mean, nobody has laughed. But the whole situation was such that when I said it, I suppose I summed up the fact that the entire weekend was horrendous, everything was ghastly, and
yes,
the haddock was just the final thing, and it summed the whole thing up in one, and the audience roared with laughter. But unfortunately, the critics mentioned it, and after that, it never, ever got a laugh.
Yes, yes.
And I often wonder, and I don't really know, I would love to know whether Dame Edith, in fact, went on getting a laugh on her handbag, Mr. Worthing, you know.
Yes,
one wonders, because the line is always in your mind when you think of the play.
Yes.
And of Dame Edith, and I often wonder if it went on
because
being as funny, and you know,
because
once,
people
it, once
were,
it had been.
Yeah, I know.
Realized.
She says something interesting on this program, actually, Maggie, which is relevant to that. She said that if she ever got a line she didn't understand, she said it as if it were improper.
Yes, well, exactly, and I have followed that.
You have?
Yes,
you
I
have.
Remember her saying that sometime
yes.
ago.
And it's something that you
yes,
think is...
Yes, say it as if it's as though it's slightly rude.
Yes.
It wasn't just Dame Edith who Maggie was compared to. When Laurence Olivier brought her to the National Theatre in 1962, according to one leading theatre critic, he knew immediately that he'd met his match.
There were footage of her with Olivier and Robert Stevens, who she was then married to, doing a restoration comedy. The three of them. Now, Olivier, one of the, you know, the best actor of his generation. Robert, another brilliant actor of his generation. And there, Maggie, absolutely toe-to-toe. You'd think, my God, in a slugging fest of acting, this woman was, you know, she was incomparable.
Over Maggie's 8 years with the National Theatre Company, they developed a professional rivalry. That is raised here by none other than Lord Olivier's widow, Dame Joan Plowright.
And Maggie, you moved in there despite your nervousness about critics.
Yes, I did. Well, I think I was more nervous of Laurence than the critics.
What?
I was more nervous of your husband than the critics. I must admit.
Well, I don't think...
As indeed everybody was,
Joan. I don't think you ever showed it.
No, everybody was. We were terrified.
Othello, 1965.
Didn't he tell you that your vowels were
right?
Yes, he
did, but I'm...
And what did you say to him when he...
What did you say?
I used to put his eyelashes on. No, he did tell me my vowels, which they're still dodgy.
"'Twill away again. Let me but bind it hard. Within an hour it will be well."
So I went in to help him with the eyelashes, and he was sitting there in all that gunge. And I said, "How now, brown cow?" And all he said was, "It was better, that's better," he said. Anyway, he got very cross with me because I wouldn't do Skin of Our Teeth.
Yes. Yes.
"Out, devil," he says. But he did knock me out.
Well, not quite.
He did.
"Mad?
Why, sweet of the girl?
Get it off!"
He hit me. "Out, devil." And I was left with some black marks on my face. Oh, dear. But I did say it was the only time I saw stars at the National Theatre. Those were the days, eh?
She was sexy and funny, and that was a great, great art. She could make you cry as Desdemona. I remember she had four words: "Oh, these men, these men," and she broke your heart. It was a wonderful production to be in. It truly was a historic production.
"I will not stand quietly by and allow myself to be crucified by a woman whose fetid frustration has overcome her judgment.
If scandal is to your taste, Miss Mackay, I shall give you a feast.
Miss Brodie!
I am a teacher. I am a teacher first, last, always. Do you imagine that for one instant I will let that be taken from me without a fight? I have dedicated, sacrificed my life to this profession, and I will not stand by like an inky little slacker and watch you rob me of it. And for what? For what reason? For jealousy?
It was the prime of Miss Jean Brodie that really turned Maggie into a star. Made in 1969, it also saw her playing opposite her then-husband and fellow acting icon, Robert Stevens.
To Robert's character, Teddy.
I hear I must congratulate you on the birth of another child.
Yes, another daughter.
Have you never heard of Mary Stopes, architect for constructive birth control and racial progress?
Ah, yes, an estimable woman. But you see, my church enjoins me to go forth and be fruitful.
I am aware of your unfortunate affiliation with the Church of Rome. I doubt, however, whether that body gives the same interpretation to go forth that you do.
Now, your husband is a distinguished actor and a busy one, too. Do you ever meet?
Yes, well, we meet quite a lot at the moment because we're working together. So we do meet, yes.
Well, we've worked together more than once. Of course, you were together in the prime of Miss Jean Brodie.
Yes, we were in that, and we have worked together a lot at the National. And that's where we're working now. So we do really see quite a lot of each other.
Which, do you enjoy? Obviously, it's nice to see each other. What's
oh, yes, because you know, when Robert was filming himself, I didn't see him at all.
Decades later, and unsurprisingly, after all the years that had passed, came a slightly different assessment.
How about working with Robert, maybe?
Well, it was tricky. A lot of times it was fine, but then it really got very tricky because he was not a well man, and that was hard because you didn't know if somebody was coming on stage or if they were indeed, what state they'd be in. A lot of it was very, very merry and lovely. So I shall remember those bits.
Yes, because you were a golden couple.
We were a golden couple,
yes.
And golden, too, was Maggie's reward for playing Miss Brodie, an Oscar for Best Actress that came to her as a genuine surprise.
Maggie.
Oh, I'm just very, very surprised. I didn't think I had a hope at all. I'm very, very pleased that I have.
What about the Oscar as an award? Do you think it really matters to an actress of your fame already?
Well, I'm not particularly famous in the film world anyway, and I think it obviously must matter because why would everybody be here?
But I mean, they go mad in Hollywood and California about it.
Yes, I believe they do. I've not been to the awards or before at any time, so I don't really know.
I mean, you just regard it as another pot on the mantelpiece, do you?
Well, I think it's always lovely to get a sort of prize.
It is the most terrifying experience ever.
Why?
I don't know. I think it's probably because it's the one award in the world that people really do not know. They just do not know. And there is something so naked and unkind. The cameras go in on all the people who are likely to get it and the hope and in their faces. And when it goes, you know, you just...
And they've all got those stitched-on smiles,
well,
haven't they?
You know, they obviously want it so desperately, and of course there it does mean much more than it does to us here.
Yes.
Oscar is a tremendous, tremendous award to get.
But did it mean anything for you, though, in real terms, Maggie, when you won it for Jean Brodie? I mean, in terms of work? I mean, did all of a sudden people start ringing you up?
No, there is a kind of... legend which has happened since the Oscars, they always sort of say that you don't work very much after you get one. I don't understand why. I think it goes back to the fact that if you won an Oscar in the old days, let us say, your salary immediately jumped enormously, and of course that cannot happen now. It's unrealistic. So the money thing doesn't come into it. But there is this odd thing that you don't get offered work because of an Oscar.
Yeah. What do you do with a statuette? Do you put it on the sideboard at home or something?
Mine is actually holding a door open.
Really?
And it's very friendly, actually. It's extremely useful for it.
Of course, winning an Oscar didn't reduce the number of parts Maggie was offered. She was by now starry enough to qualify for those all-star productions so beloved of Hollywood in the 1970s. like 1978's adaptation of Agatha Christie's Death on the Nile.
Come along now, back to the cabin. Time for your massage.
My companion vows. She did 15 rounds once with Jack Dempsey. He was never the same man again.
Sorry, Miss Ridgway.
Mrs. Doyle. Mrs. Simon Doyle. You have got to forgive Miss Bowles. She's just unfamiliar with the marriage state.
I saw you drooling over her pearls.
Shut up, Bowles.
You'd give every tooth in your head to lay your hands on them.
What nonsense, just because you've got a grudge against her, or rather her father. No need to be uncivil.
Grudge? Malouish Ridgway ruined my family.
Well, you should be grateful. If he hadn't, you'd have missed the pleasure of working for me.
Could kill her on that score alone.
Roles in films like these, alongside some of cinema's biggest names, made it easy to forget that she'd once not liked being in front of the camera.
Do you enjoy filming?
Not very much, no.
Why not?
It's, I don't know. I think you have to be a screen actress. I really don't think I am. I think you have to have a completely different outlook. You know, by the time I get on the floor after 2.5 hours of makeup, I find it impossible. And also the lack of contact, the fact that there isn't an audience, the fact that it's all a question of how you look. People are always, always worried, always around you all the time, trying to make you look like this, your costume isn't right. I don't know, I found by the end of the day that one's morale was so low, but maybe the camera is so close that you feel you can't do anything because it will look ugly. You know, you get so concerned with the fact that you're in the wrong light, or if you do that, it's unattractive on the camera and you mustn't do this. You get so inhibited, at least I do, that I tend not to do anything. I always feel that I'm fine if I'm acting a neurotic person or a small, tight, you know, shy person. That's not quite so difficult.
And yet, perhaps the future dame did protest too much. She was clearly a natural, and co-stars knew immediately that they'd have to work hard to keep up with her. In one of Maggie's first film roles, in The VIPs, no less a star than Richard Burton complained that Maggie didn't just steal a big scene from him, she committed grand larceny.
Mr. Andros?
Hmm?
I don't suppose you've ever before been approached by a perfectly strange woman in a hotel lounge asking you for £153,750.
Another ensemble production was California Suite, for which Maggie won another Oscar, this time for Best Supporting Actress.
Who was it, Sydney?
What are you talking about?
That adorable young actor you were chatting with all night. Gorgeous, wasn't he? Where did you find him?
He was at our table. We shared a butter plate.
How spreadably cosy.
Careful, darling. We're tired and we're smashed. Let's not get into shallow waters.
Oh, I am sorry. Let's just talk showbiz, shall we?
Maggie's co-star, Michael Caine, said that acting with her was like attending a one-woman masterclass on comic technique. One that he would gladly enroll in again. A few years later, when Michael Palin was about to work with Maggie on The Missionary, Caine said to him, "She's brilliant, but watch her. She'll have every scene from under your feet."
Why pretend?
Pretend?
I know why you came here today.
Look, I think if we confine ourselves to financial matters, it'll be better for both of us.
Don't you find me attractive?
No, it's not that at all.
Why did you follow me in the street the other day?
Follow you?
In London.
I wasn't following you.
Why did you attack me on the boat?
That was an accident.
Why did you get your fiancée to write to me?
Pure coincidence.
Are you in love with her?
We've been in love for 11 years.
You've been away 10.
Maggie, a little bit about the part, and can you fill in a few details of the plot for us?
Well, the part that I play is Lady Ames, who is going to provide the missionary with money for the fallen women. And then I fall in love with him and things get out of hand. But as to the rest of it, It's really up to Michael to tell you about that.
She can't remember, frankly.
Yes, Michael.
It's been a long time ago now, she's only read the script once.
But it does obviously enable you to display your very ladylike talents. You love the kind of grand dame parts, don't you?
Well, I did. I enjoyed playing that. I haven't played many of the grand dame parts.
The characters you've written, Michael, are they're beautifully... You've had some very nice crits, actually, about the characters. Have you enjoyed putting them together? There aren't two quite dotty people in it, aren't there?
Oh, yes. I mean, I think people are slightly disappointed because I play a fairly straight role, but that's very important, I think, have someone in the middle there around whom a sort of galaxy of very, very strange and eccentric characters
like evolve. A general, for example.
Yeah, so Trevor Howard, who is Maggie's husband, he's the richest man in England, who's extraordinarily reactionary, is always writing letters to the Times about new and more nasty methods of capital punishment. He believes that capital punishments are too good for murderers. And he actually dies in his study in 1912 while devising a less humane method of garrotting. So there's this mad, crazy lunatic. And also Michael Horden, Sir Michael Horden, as he is now, plays a butler with absolutely no sense of direction and a total amnesiac who is the butler of this family. And the three of them together, it's a wonderful scene.
You have time to admire the other characters, do you?
Oh, yes, very much so. And I do think Sir Michael, you're quite right, he's amazing. And he really was so funny. I mean, funny in the way that he was just so eccentric. Yeah.
From an interview with Frank Boff on BBC's Breakfast Time to a butler announcing a visitor in a grand Edwardian drawing room.
Lady Ames.
Ames.
Mr. Forrester to see you, my lady.
Lady Ames looks taken aback as the missionary approaches her husband.
Good afternoon, sir. My name is Fortescue. I'm a missionary. I had the great good fortune of meeting you and your wife in London recently.
Never set eyes on you.
Well, Maggie Smith, when I see you performing like that on film, it's surprising to hear that you do have a preference for the stage, don't you? Why is that?
Why do I have a preference for the stage? I think it's probably because I've done more on the stage than I have on film.
Is it the discipline of film, which is very set piece and sort of, you know, pieces
the
put
thing
together?
That I always, no, the, yes, the thing I always find difficult on film is the fact that it is always, it's so out of sequence. Mm. And this one really was. This was way out of sequence.
Did it have to be, Michael? Difficult to shoot?
Well, actors always come right down the bottom of the order of things, and it was really where we could get the locations. And the very first shot we did with Maggie had to stand up to her knees in the Thames mud at about, even earlier than this, it was about 5:30 in the morning that we actually did that very first shot. And I said, well, can't we just break her in, give her a nice shot with some nice sort of... nice outfit on for the first day. I said, no, sorry, it's the only day we've got the barge, because there's a lovely shot with the barge, period.
But she wasn't difficult, she wasn't terribly actressy about it.
Oh, no, not at all. In fact, we forgot she was there. The tide came up and we could only just see the sort of top of her head.
But I was numb at the time.
Now dishevelled and shabbily dressed, Lady Ames looks up from the banks of the Thames and beams at Fortescue.
Maggie would work again with Michael Palin on the 1984 film A Private Function, written by Alan Bennett, and a real gem of a film. But it was another master of British comedy, Kenneth Williams, who was perhaps her closest creative companion over the years.
I mean, there was one point in my career when I really thought I would never, ever get out of revue, let alone get into a play. I mean, I thought I would be clamped with Kenneth Williams for life.
Her association with Kenneth Williams, you could see in her mind so much.
To be in Maggie Smith's dressing room with Kenneth Williams, and it was wonderful. And it was a show. It was wonderfully funny.
They had met in 1957 in a review show called Share My Lettuce, and shared a close relationship from that moment on.
Now, Maggie, it's as a comedienne that you're best known, and so let's talk specifically about comedy, and to help us do that, we've brought along an old friend of yours, Kenneth Williams. Come in, Kenneth. Come sit down here.
Thank you.
Hello.
Hello. Kenneth phoned me up one morning.
Oh, yes.
And said that he'd read a marvellous play, and I ought to get in touch with my agent straight away because there was a great part in it for me. Thought I'd be absolutely marvellous in it. And I said, oh, I'm doing it, Kenneth. And he said, oh, you are mean. You might have said that you thought I'd be good in it.
And then, of course, do you remember what happened after that?
We decided to have a meeting to discuss it. Do you remember?
No.
Yes, we did. And you came round to the flat. And you said, well, what are you going to do with it? And, you know, and, of course, this is one of the reasons why we're really not the sort of people to discuss comedy at all.
No.
Because we both have a horror of really dissecting it. You know, we both believe in the idea of getting a technical sort of excellence, I mean, the learning with the moves and all that kind of thing, but with the idea that the audience only is what's going to teach you anything about the playing of comedy. Now, this is a belief we both share, isn't it?
Well, yes, it's in part, because it endlessly happens in rehearsal when people say, well, I think there's a laugh there, and both Ken and I would go, oh, don't say it.
Yes.
Because the yes. moment you decide whether anything funny is going to happen, you've more or less killed it.
Does it bother you when critics take your work to task?
Well, yeah, well, naturally, because, you know, they're read. They're read sometimes by me, and they can hurt and wound one. Really, in actual fact, with a film, there's nothing one can do. It is there.
Yeah, right.
And it's finished. Mm. If it's a comedy, and I'm sure Ken will agree with this, that... if you know that they're not really good, or if they're in any way damaging, then it's best to keep away, because, as I said, comedy is fragile, and if you're going to be struck down or gloomy, it's very hard to buoy yourself up and your spirits back.
Yes. Do you get affected like that, Kenneth?
Loathe them, and I've got a record of saying how much I loathe them so many times. It's almost become commonplace, you know. I regard them as...
But Kenneth...
I've always said they're the eunuchs in the harem, you know. They're there every night, they see it done every night, but they can't do it themselves.
Maggie, Parkinson and Betjeman crack up.
Absolutely useless, you see, and there's a marvellous...
But they're not always, Ken, because always there's a grain of truth. That's what's so unnerving.
One day, Kenneth came to see a performance, and he went round to see Maggie afterwards, and she sent a message, come and to her dressing room. This was after the matinee. And I walked in, and I was a fan of Kenneth Williams, and there we were, the three of us, having tea and chatting rather loudly. And next door, in the adjoining dressing room, was Olivier, having played Othello, having a bit of a rest. And we were making a bit of a noise, and it was Kenneth Williams who said, shouldn't we... turn it down a bit because himself is whistling. And Maggie, I will never forget, said, no, she said, I'm going to let the old bugger not have any rest between shows. I want him tired out for tonight.
Rehearsing a comedy must be 20 times more difficult than rehearsing any other kind of play. How do you know where the laughs are going to come? How do you
well, decide? You don't. This is what we're saying. You know on the really with an audience. I mean, you have an idea, you read a script and certain things in it make you laugh and you think that's a funny idea, and of course that will... One can work for a laugh in that way. It's not necessarily a laugh, it's a humorous passage, maybe, that you know that you can extract something from it and make it into a comedy situation or something.
One of the extraordinary things about you as an actress and as a comedian is the way that you can take lines. There's a line, for instance, in Trelawney of the Worlds, when you say... I think that's rotten, absolutely rotten.
Oh, about the part of... yeah.
Could you just say the line?
And she says, oh, that's a rotten part. And has to say to the other guy, oh, I assure you, Rose, this artist to artist, that part is absolutely rotten. But, I mean, that's... I mean, you remember that because it's sort of very... I suppose it's a very vivid way of doing it.
But on the page...
That is something that... I mean, that's very much something that Ken taught me. Ken, eventually one day in that awful office at the Queen's Theatre, said, look, Ducky, awful day. He said, you know, you're being absolutely boring. And sort of went through it sentence by sentence and said, you must make it. You would never say a sentence like that. You just wouldn't. I mean, I'm talking now and waving my arms around and stressing certain words. And Ken said, that's what you must do. I mean, I was literally learning a speech and just saying it as a speech, thinking, oh, how very clever, I've learned all the words. I'd never thought of colouring things as vividly as Kenneth does. I'd never thought of doing it, or I'd never had to do it. I'd never been in a modern play, I suppose. But I'd never thought that one could make a speech that alive.
By taking it apart and by making it
like conversation, making it much more...
and making it immediate.
Mm.
Yes, it is immediacy in actual fact, which is the greatest kind of gift in comedy. Because it's what you were saying earlier on about the challenge nightly with an audience, to make it seem as though it is coming out for the first time.
Yes,
to make
and
it
also,
seem that thoughts are occurring.
Also, yes, absolutely, and that you surprise the audience an awful lot of the time.
Yes.
I mean, a thought comes to you very quickly, and therefore it surprises the audience. It's rather like, you know, the quickness of the hand deceives the eyes. It's the same thing with comedy. You need to be a bit... have a quirk. I mean, you have to look at things at an odd angle to get the comedy out of them.
Yes.
I mean, you really have to see the madness.
Insights like that were always fascinating to the actors who followed Maggie, often in a mixed state of envy and awe.
Are you telling me we go to bed by 9?
If I were you, I would use this time to think about my life and its direction, or lack thereof.
There's nothing wrong with my life. You know, before I came here, I had a career, I had friends, I had clothing that fit. Before I came here, I was okay.
Oh, really? From what I've heard, your singing career was almost non-existent, and your married lover wants you dead. If you're fooling anyone, it is only yourself. God has brought you here. Take the hint.
For any daring to enter the world of comic performance, no matter which generation you came from, she was an absolute inspiration.
I played Mother Superior in a recent production of Sister Act at the Dominion Theatre, and the role was originally played by Dame Maggie Smith. And when I started rehearsals, I actually had a dream that I told Maggie Smith I was playing Mother Superior Welsh, because that's what I did do. And she was absolutely horrified. She went, "Welsh? You're playing her Welsh? Oh, no, 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 no." So, yeah, I was very honoured that she visited me in my dreams.
Sister Act was heavily promoted with the punning slogan, "There's none better," which could have easily applied to Maggie herself. This was an extraordinary period for her. In the 1980s, she won the Best Actress BAFTA 3 times. And from then on, across big films and small, it was rare for a review to mention Maggie in anything but glowing terms. It was A Room with a View that saw her first share the big screen with her dear friend, Dame Judi Dench.
In the Italian countryside...
And she never went back to Weybridge. Her friend had to return without her. She remained at Monteriano.
And did she really?
Her companions stare at Maggie's character, Charlotte.
No, no, don't be alarmed. This is not a cold. It's just a slight cough. I've had it for 3 days. It has nothing to do with sitting on the ground.
However, Maggie and Judy's shared cinematic experiences weren't always enjoyable ones.
I think of this quite a lot, that Mags and I did Ladies in Lavender with Charlie Dance, and we were in a little cottage in Prussia Cove, and it was unbelievably hot. And I have just this wonderful memory of Maggie and I being absolutely livid at lunchtime. We'd be sitting at the top of this little cottage playing cards. Somebody would bring us lunch, while the whole of the crew, because it was so hot, just dived into the sea. We're having the most wonderful time in the sea. My idea of bliss. And Max and I just furious in this top room. It's a very nice memory to have. Oh, she could be very scary. Oh, yes, no question. She could be quite frightening. Don't want to be on the wrong side of Max.
I'm sorry, you have to laugh. She terrified you. Yes, she was terrifying. Because she was so gifted. I was just in awe of her. But you had to get over that. Being in awe of her didn't last because she wouldn't let it last. You know, we don't get anywhere if you're so in awe of me that you won't act with me.
So, no question that Maggie could be slightly scary.
You are
extremely rude, young men. No gentleman would ever dream of entering a lady's room without first knocking. Now go outside, count to 10, and then knock.
But being on the receiving end of one of her famous caustic put-downs could also be a real badge of honour.
Ian, would you mind telling us the story about when you were nominated for Gandalf? And you had the beads?
Yeah. Well, they weren't beads. New Zealand, where we filmed Lord of the Rings, if you're lucky, when you leave, you're given a piece of green stone, carved, and you wear it often enough, and your chances are that you'll get back to New Zealand. That's the idea. And it'll bring you a bit of luck. So, when those films were nominated for something like 20 Oscars on that night, everybody from New Zealand was wearing their green stone, their punami, they're called. And when we're on the red carpet going into the ceremony, I met Maggie Smith. Hello, what are you here for? I said, well...
Ian McKellen is with Patrick Stewart and Hugh Jackman on The Graham Norton Show.
I said, well, Lord of the Rings. Oh, yeah. She said, what's that round your neck? Oh, so it's my punami, Maggie. Oh, your punami, what's that for? I said, well, if I wear it, it'll bring me luck. And, oh, very nice. And we went our separate ways, and you know it lasts for 3.5 or 4 hours, yeah. You know, don't you?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, God, you sit there and sit there. And at the end, of course, everyone else wins the Oscar apart from you. And a bit dejected, you're coming out looking forward to a drink, and you bump into Maggie Smith, and she points out at you and she says, it didn't work, did it?
Now, here's a rare treat. We're heading to Italy and Florence to enjoy Maggie perhaps at her most at ease. Relaxed and enjoying somewhere she loved with her friend, the architect and historian, Francesco D'Amosto.
I've got a date with my mother-in-law's best friend. We are going to see the sights together.
Francesco! Hello.
Great to see you.
Great.
Oh, I'm going to take you to the Brancaccia Chapel. It's okay. Adam and Eve. Yeah, I'm feeling holiday here. Why English they love so much? Yeah.
Florence.
Tuscany.
Well, I don't think it's not just the English. But everyone. I think it started, well, I suppose it started with the Grand Tour, didn't it? I mean, when people
could,
and they all decided that they wanted to see all the art, because everywhere you turn there's art here. Also, I fancy that I'd see all the nudes.
Arm in arm, they wander through the centre of the city.
Maggie, Dame Maggie Smith to you, British, is the Queen of Florence. She's always filming here. A room with a view, tea with Mussolini. She loves it.
It was a wonderful time being here. And the fact that we could clear all the place and make it look as though it was really that period, it was wonderful. I remember they all went around painting all the graffiti out.
Oh, there was.
It really looked so ravishing.
The equestrian statue of Ferdinando de' Medici, then a colonnade. In a church, she consults a book as they admire a fresco above an altar featuring a distressed naked couple being dismissed by a winged figure in red, wielding a sword.
This is the Cappella Brancacci. We've come to see Masaccio's Adam and Eve.
Yeah. Let me have a look and see what it says here. Here the beauty of the nude was first revealed, and here a calm dignity for the first time in...
Sophie, can you stop and we try to feel something about the thing?
No, just look.
Yeah. Sometimes the English read a little too much.
Quite right.
Yeah.
This is out of date anyway.
Yeah.
No words can express the intensity of emotion in Masaccio's timeless image of human sorrow.
a man with a halo blessing a woman on a bed.
This chapel is a window back in time to the streets of Florence in the 15th century.
A fresco of several figures walking past an old man in rags clutching his shoulders.
So, well, I've had a lovely...
It was marvellous.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Do you really have my present?
One second, I forgot it.
What?
A little present from Venice.
Oh, darling, how sweet. Thank you so much.
I hope you like
it. Oh, it's beautiful. It's beautiful.
You know, like those dresses of Fortuny?
Yeah, it's a Fortuny fabric. Look at that.
A purple purse with a flat, round base.
It was unusual for Maggie to let the cameras capture the real her. Despite all those wonderful performances on the big and small screens, Maggie's non-acting appearances on television were few. But this is another very nice exchange from her encounter back in 1993 with the BBC's Barry Norman.
Something you did, very small part, in a film which I always think was greatly underrated, and that's Oh, What a Lovely War, Dickie Attenborough's.
Oh, yeah.
What I thought was fascinating about that was that when we first see you, you were terribly glamorous on the stage, and you continue to be glamorous throughout the song, and then suddenly there's a quite harsh close-up, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm very proud of that, because it was my idea. And
oh, was it?
Yeah. So I was very, very pleased with that. But that is a very frightening thing when you see them with an enormous amount of makeup and looking completely startling and ludicrous, really.
I've got a clip of that to show you as well.
Oh.
He was singing.
I don't think I can even listen to this.
If only other girls would do as I do, I believe that we could manage it alone. But I turn all suitors from me, but the sailor and the Tommy. I've an army and a navy of my own. On Sunday, I walk out with the soldier. Monday, I'm taken by a tar. Tuesday, I'm out with a baby boy scout. On Wednesday, ah, huzzah! On Thursday, I gang out with a Scotty. On Friday, the captain of the crew. But on Saturday, I'm willing, if you'll only take the shilling, to make a man of any one of you.
No, I enjoyed that. You obviously didn't. You sat there with your fingers in your ears.
No, I've never been able to sing. Never, ever.
When you look back now over your career, you must be fairly chuffed at the way things have turned out.
Nothing has changed. It's still as precarious as it ever was. I mean, there's another wonderful thing that I wanted to do with Lindsay Anderson, and we're trying to set it up. It's a Chekhov, and, of course, that's difficult. And the producer had sent it to several companies. God knows, it might be this one, for all I know. And he got a letter back which said, "Dear Mr. Chekhov, thank you for..." Now, that's terrifying, isn't it? I have seen a Xerox of the letter.
I mean, you must take satisfaction out of some of the things you've done.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, I'm not saying I don't, but I'm just saying it doesn't guarantee that you will ever do anything else.
So if I say, "What does the future hold?" You are going to say you haven't the faintest idea.
I haven't the faintest idea. I really haven't the faintest idea. But it'd better be something soon, because I shall drive everybody mad if I don't work, I know that.
There was never any danger of Maggie not working, and of course her reputation grew and grew. Eventually came the extraordinary double whammy of the Harry Potter films and Downton Abbey.
Professor McGonagall?
The shadow of a grey tabby cat grows into the form of the bespectacled Professor McGonagall in her long robes and pointed hat with a round brim.
Good evening, Professor Dumbledore.
Maggie waves to the audience as if casting a spell on the Graham Norton show.
But that did sort of change your life in a way.
Well, yes, a lot of very small people kind of... used to say hello to me, and that was nice. And it was a whole different lot of people.
Yes, but also so weird that they'd only know you for that one thing, like you'd never existed before.
No, I never had. And except one kid once said to me, he said, "Were you really a cat?"
And I heard myself say, just pull yourself together. How could I have been? Anyway.
So there's, the Harry Potter bit of your life, which kind of changed your life, but then Downton comes along. Okay.
A picture of Maggie as Violet Crawley.
Is that one of those things where you thought you were famous till you were in Downton?
No, I didn't think that at all. It's only since Downton that people seem to know, you know, who stopped me and asked me. But it's only since Downton, and that's television for you.
Yes, it's common.
It's television. But funnily enough, I was in Waitrose in Storrington, my favourite, and a little boy was at the checkout with his mother, and he kept looking at me. And I thought, what am I going to do about it? And he went, kept looking at me and looking at me. And I said, can I help you? And he said, it's all right, it'll come to me in a minute. I thought it was so sweet. So lovely. It will come to me. Sweet.
So are you in a way sort of glad that Downton's over?
Oh, yeah. No, I really am. No, because, honestly, she was about... By the time we finished, she must have been 110. So I couldn't go on and on and on. I couldn't. It just didn't make sense.
I know, Alex, I know you're a big Downton fan.
I am. I shout at it a lot.
You haven't seen it.
I do, yeah, we watch it, and we shout at it, because I'm not in it.
Have you ever watched Downton?
She smiles, then shakes her head.
Not.
I've got the box set.
Maggie would carry on both stage and screen well into her 80s. She'd always insist that she'd never retire, saying of acting, I love it, I'm privileged to do it, and I don't know where I'd be without it. And when she died, just 3 months before what would have been her 90th birthday, the loss felt huge, and that line was echoed back by admirers and friends across the world who loved her, who were privileged to have had her in their lives, and now feel far, far emptier without her there. And I'd like to quote Dame Penelope Wilton, her dear friend. We were very lucky to have worked with Mags. She has finally left the stage, and we won't see her like again.
She was the best of them all.
You're well missed, Maggie. You will be missed forever.
I've got trees to everybody who are away, and that tree we put in for Max turns out to be a crab apple tree. And on the day of her funeral, Joe, who works for me, came in and he had one little crab apple. He said, look what's come out on the tree. And so I had it in my pocket at her funeral, which was a very nice thing to have. We had such good times.
A piece of slate hanging on a tree bearing Maggie's name.
By any other name it would still smell as sweet. Scrab, bitters, gall, gribble and scrug. It's a rose, but by another name.